And now I'd like to introduce the Secretary of Education of the United States of America, Margaret Spellings, who's with us today to make comments on whatever she wants to, but I hope she'll talk about No Child Left Behind before she leaves. Secretary Spellings, thank you for being with us. We're honored.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for that. Well, I guess it's a warm welcome. I don't know about that. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, for being here, and thank you all of you on the board for your service and for your good partnership as we all work together on No Child Left Behind. Kent, it's great to see you again.
Good to see you again.
In good shape, and you have been our partner for a long time, and I hope that that will continue for even longer. And the reason I'm here, and I was just telling Dr. King that this is my 11th state to visit since the first of the year, and I plan to get around to close to half the states, is to talk about where we are with No Child Left Behind. As I know you all are well aware, the law is up for reauthorization. This last year, we did not get it done, and we may not get it done this year. I had the great fortune to work at the White House for the first 4 years of the president's administration, and I've been there on day one, and I know that it's unlikely that the new president, whoever they are, is going to show up on day one and work on George Bush's number one domestic achievement. So all of us in the school business are going to have school. And obviously my fond, fervent hope is that we'll get a good law done this year, but if we don't, what are the things that I should be thinking about and doing this year to lay the groundwork, to develop best practices, and to make sure that if it's 2 or 3 years before we get a new law, that we make it work as well as possible. And Missouri is my 11th state to visit in the last, 6 weeks or so. And I'm encouraged by a lot of the consensus around the issues that we're hearing that need to be addressed. And I want to interact with you about what some of those are. So that's why I'm here. I told Kent, I think the way I capture where we are in education is to say that we're pleased but not satisfied. We've worked hard. We've made good progress. The trend lines are going in the right direction. We are seeing the achievement gap close around the country. That's true here. We are focused, I think, more intently on the needs of every child than we ever have been, and at least in the 25 years or so that I've been in this business. And, the conversation that we're having today is different from that which we had, 6 or 8 years ago. It is not about whether or not we should, leave children behind or whatever. It's now all about kind of how are we going to do it. What are the ways, what are the best practices, what are the proper assessments, and so on. And so I think it's a very different conversation than we might have been having, 6 or 8 years ago. You all have led on some very key and important things, and I know there are issues that you're still working on and you're maybe struggling with more than others, but I'm really proud of the fact that you have had your standards are so high. I mean, Massachusetts gets a lot of airtime about their high standards, but I think a little known fact is that Missouri's are right up there and very, very strong. And there's often, I think, some anomalies about that. People think, well, you'll find a lot of northeastern states toward the top and southern and midwestern states toward the bottom. That's not true. You'll see South Carolina, Louisiana, Missouri, Massachusetts in that top tier, and, sadly, places like my home state, and I've talked to them about this, of Texas in that kind of bottom half. And anyway, I'm very pleased that you all have hold yourselves to high standards, and obviously your kids. You've invested in data systems and the ability to manage information that can be useful and put into practice. That's certainly an area where you've led as well. And I think the fact that you've embraced this sort of P20 idea, the notion that we have to think about early childhood development and school, the K-12 day, and what happens after is another place that you all have led, and certainly the governor has talked a lot about that, as you're well aware. As we know, you are challenged with meeting No Child Left Behind targets. Obviously, that's, in part because you've set the bar high. That's obviously something that I think parents and taxpayers understand. They get the trade-off, and not all states have made that same call. So I think that's important. We also are pleased that you all have just received almost a $2 million school improvement grant, and I'll talk a little bit about what I see as a key issue on that front. As I've traveled to the 11 places, and certainly this is true in our conversations last year, my observation is that no legislative body has ever passed a perfect law. And we passed the best No Child Left Behind as we could 6 years ago, but now we can make it work better. And I think there's a lot of consensus about what those key issue areas are, and this is where I want to engage with you. One of them is the idea that we need to give our educators and our schools credit for the progress that they're making over time, that this value-added approach, this growth model kind of notion is potentially a fairer, better way to provide school accountability. I have given 9 states waivers from the statute to experiment with this kind of idea. I've recently made that opportunity available to all states, and you all have applied for that opportunity, and we are just beginning the peer review process, and I hope that that will be that you all will make the list of growth model states, because I do think it's potentially a good way to provide school accountability. The reason that we didn't do that 6 years ago is we didn't have annual data systems very many places. We had about 10 states that could do that. By 05-06, we are up to about half the states, and now fully all states, because of the data investment and the ability to track progress more accurately, we're in a place when we can do that. So the whole growth model idea. The second thing that I'm observing and hearing from states is that we need a more kind of nuanced approach to accountability. As you all know, No Child Left Behind is kind of a pass-fail system. And we don't often make distinctions between those, you know, chronic underperformers and those schools that are in range. And what are the things that we can do across that spectrum to make the accountability system more nuanced and make distinctions? Obviously, this $2 million that you've just received is pointed at the needs of kind of that triage group of schools, the so-called dropout factories and things like that, that we read about. So that's certainly a topic for discussion. The third thing is our high schools. We all know that No Child Left Behind is largely about reading and math, early and middle school grades. But what about our high schools? And, you know, there's a lot of consensus, obviously, in the business community, clearly, but with the governors about the need to make sure that every child has opportunity for a high-quality, rigorous, relevant high school education, particularly when we're getting about half of our minority kids out of high school on time, and most of the jobs are going to require, 16 years of education. So third topic. Fourth is the issue of teachers. And, you know, we can't do any of our work, obviously, well without high-quality teachers where we need to have them. And one of the things that I think is often the dirty little secret of education is that sometimes our very best people are in our least challenging educational settings and vice versa. If you have a PhD, you're, you know, in cream puff high, and if you are brand new, you're in inner city, you know, fill in the blank. And we need to find ways to get our very best teachers doing the hardest work and reward them for doing it. And what are some of the things that we can do to make that more attractive and attract and recruit and retain our best teachers? Finally, obviously, resources are an issue. I expect that the Congress will appropriate more for No Child Left Behind, as has been done every year. There's about a, you know, 54% increase in federal funding since the president took office for Missouri. It's kind of a good news, bad news scenario. From last year, we had a large cut to the Reading First program, about a 60% cut, which is really going to pinch. That's the bad news. The good news is there's more Title I money. So, you know, it gives states, I guess, more latitude to figure out, you know, allocating resources around reading or other needs. And obviously, I'm well aware that resources are an ongoing issue, not only at the federal level, but clearly in the state legislature and the local school board and every other place. So I'll just stipulate that right off the top. So those are the things that I want to visit with you about. You know, this is a time that I am willing and want to engage with you all and think about the sorts of things I can do between now and the end of my term in January of next year to make this law work as well as possible. And that's why I'm here.
You're welcome. We're glad to have you here.
All right.
We are pleased to have you, and pleased that you'd come through this storm to get here.
I didn't realize I was going to have to do that. Well, when I signed up.
Then I was giving you more credit than you deserve, I guess. But thank you for being here. We are honored that you're here. I'm going to open this for questions directed at Secretary Spellings, if you would like. this is usually not a very shy group.
I'd like to. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Shirley.
All right. I'm a former special education teacher, mentally handicapped, learning disabled, and gifted. And when I heard you were coming, I spoke to several teachers in our vicinity and asked what were their biggest concerns. And it seems that the special ed teachers is we are so overburdened with paperwork. And now when our children are expected to test out at a certain point, we find it's next to impossible with these mentally challenged students. And therefore, it is also pulling down the scores of the whole school. What I'm wondering is, can these children be looked at a little bit differently, their expectations, and also is there anything that can be done regarding the tremendous amount of paperwork that's required for these teachers?
Let me start with that one, and I know you all hear it, you know, by virtue of things that you policy decisions you make at the state level and local school board as well. And it's one of the things that, you know, nobody's for burdensome bureaucracy and paperwork. And until we get specific about, you know, what does that mean and who the perpetrator is, it's hard for me to react to. No Child Left Behind, as you know, calls for, you know, one annual assessment in reading and math. And I think there's some confusion, particularly as it trickles down to teachers. You know, they get it on top of their heads and they don't know, is that a federal provision or a state provision or a local school board thing or what. So for us at the policy level to try to sort through some of that duplication, that's an area I'd certainly welcome working on. One of the my observation is that to the extent that states are more focused on assessments, that they're putting in additional benchmarks along the way, which I would probably do if I were at the state level, but that is part of where that burden is coming from. And, you know, anyway, let's get specific about that and find out, you know, are we duplicating record-keeping requirements between federal policy, state policy, and local policy, and see if we can streamline some of that. With respect to the special ed issue generally, when I first came to office, you know, there was a 1% provision that we knew for sure that 1% of our kids were so profoundly disabled that they shouldn't be part of any accountability system. And I asked my friends over at the National Institutes of Health and Child Development about, you know, what the rest of the population looked like. And they told me that there's an additional 2% or so that needs additional time, different strategies, different assessments, and I've put that flexibility in place. I believe you've taken advantage of that, Kent. And I think that's appropriate. We are now, and I think this is, again, a place where the growth model can be valuable to us so that we chart, you know, progress from where kids are to where they're going. And I think that's one policy tool. I also think this is the need to drive good practice on assessment and intervention is also, you know, being developed because of this accountability provision here. And I know this is very unfashionable to say this, but your neighbors in Kansas are leaders on special ed assessment issues. Alexa Posney, who's the chief over there, worked for me for a couple of years or so. And there are some, they're not the only model, but there are some models around the country that I think can be helpful. And the growth model, I think, can help us there.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up to that, Shirley? It's the only question right now?
That's it now.
Okay. David?
I had the opportunity to attend the NASB's Governmental Affairs Committee last January, and a representative from Senator Kennedy's representative from Senator Kennedy's office came and talked about reauthorization of No Child Left Behind and how they were working on that. And almost a sense of urgency, he was telling our group of 20 because of the election and and what might happen if various people win. And so it kind of gets back. You basically early kind of talked about it, but what do you think the likelihood of reauthorization of that is? In your opinion, is it?
You know, if I could handicap the Congress, I don't know where I'd be, but I probably wouldn't be in Jefferson City. Who knows? And, you know, it is a tricky, tricky proposition. And one of the things that I think has been, you know, I appreciate Senator Kennedy so much and Chairman Miller. We have had strong bipartisan support for the core principles of this law. Mm-hmm. And they have been, you know, vigilant supporters of it. And, you know, they call this in Washington the silly season. I mean, this is not necessarily the time for a lot of rationality around policymaking. I hope that we will get to a place, and I think the way he sees a potential scenario is that the primaries will settle out and there'll be kind of a policy vacuum that will allow kind of cooler heads to prevail and for us to get some work done around these, I'm calling them the sweet spot issues that I've talked with you about. I mean, there's broad agreement around a lot of these issues. And but obviously there are lots of people who are wanting to, you know, detract from the core principles of the law as well. So I hope so. I'm going to work hard with them to see if we can get it done. That's the perfect world scenario to provide that certainty for another 6 years. But if we don't, I don't want to, you know, burn through the daylight that I have to make the law work as well as possible. I think if we don't get it done this year, it is highly unlikely it'll get done next year. And then they'll begin a process that will take us well into the second year of an administration. So
that's exactly what the Kennedy's office was saying. Exactly. But he was pretty optimistic. I don't know. But I was optimistic because of it, his office, and I know the president both seemed to were on, like you say, on the key issues.
Yeah.
We're in agreement.
Yeah.
And so it's.
Well, if anybody can do it, he can. I'll also say
so,
that.
So, okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
About the president there?
Kennedy. I mean,
oh.
Yeah. I mean, from a legislative point of view, obviously.
Debbie, did you have a question?
Well, I have a question, but I had a comment also because a year ago in June, not last June, but a year before, I was in the same Governmental Affairs Committee hearing the same Kennedy staff person with the same urgency. And that's we're now in 2 years past that mm-hmm. sense of urgency. So yeah, just a comment
there you
on
have
that.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. The fourth issue that you brought up is the idea of finding, attracting, and retaining teachers. And for me, the thing that is going to really impact education the most is the teacher in the classroom. We can do so much peripherally, but without that good teacher, I don't know how we're going to accomplish anything. And it's very worrisome because I don't think we're it doesn't look like in the future we're producing these. So I know there are ways to try to bring more teachers in. Alternative certification is one of them. And it seems to me, I think I heard that MU has found maybe 20 or fewer teachers that are going to be graduating in the math and science area. 20? That is scary.
Last year there was one in physics.
Mm-hmm. That is very troublesome. So to me, it seems like the only way immediately that we're going to be able to solve this is through some sort of alternative certification programs. And I have to admit, I'm not very familiar with them, but I wondered where you were going. I know I've heard of one called the American Board. Do you have any information on ones that would be good that we can get highly qualified people from the business community in to help in the immediate future?
You bet. And I think you're right. I mean, you know, I wish that we had a system that was developing the numbers that we needed, but it just doesn't look like that's the case, at least in the short term. That's the bad news. The good news is programs like Teach for America, I mean, it's the number one recruiter on college campuses these days. I think our kids, our young people are interested in service. This is a generation that wants to give back, but, you know, every measure. Teach for America is oversubscribed. I think they had 18,000 applicants for 2,900 positions. I know they've come, they have a presence in St. Louis, I believe.
Right, pretty good number.
Yeah.
And in a couple of suburbs.
And so I think programs like that, Troops to Teachers, is another transition to teaching program. There's a program called the New Teacher Project. There are a variety of them. I'm seeing in urban centers in particular, school districts develop their own alternative certification programs that are kind of tailor-made for their district. Now, obviously this gets into your state licensure laws and so forth. I don't know if you have jurisdiction over those sorts of things, but the ability for other producers or providers, or if school districts have the authority to do that sort of thing. But I think we are going to have to figure out how to recruit mid-career professionals into our classrooms and have them become, you know, highly qualified teachers, if you will. I also think this is a place for technology that we're going to have to, particularly around some of these high-need subject areas that we, you know, the one physics teacher is not going to get it for the competitive world. We're just going to have to think differently about it than we have.
And new teachers are not staying in the profession. After they come in, I think I read the other day, the average is 5 years that they're staying.
And, you know, as odd as this sounds, I mean, if that's our new reality, the new normal, as they say, what are things that we can do to ramp up that kind of kid? I mean, what if we had every great young American come and do 5 years of good service in education?
You know, I began teaching in a one-room school back in the pioneer days, but I was happy every day to go to school, and our teachers are not happy in our vicinity. And right now, they're blaming a lot of this unhappiness on No Child Left Behind. All the requirements is happening. So I don't know. I hear a lot of flack.
Stan, you had a question?
Yeah, just with some of the things that are being put in place, the P20 and some of the others, there seems to be a broader scope on what education actually means in the city. My concern, as I look at No Child Left Behind, is we had to make a decision as to whether or not we were going to get into the business of education or we would take a holistic approach at the impact of the child as a result of education. And it seems like, one, you take an approach like an assembly line. Everything that comes in, it's all the same. We stamp these things on it, and then we send it on through. The other one, you look at it as in a very different model because you recognize the environmental impact. So everything that comes in is going to be different, and I'm going to have to assess that to determine what value added will make this really reach kind of what the ultimate goal is. One is a village approach. The other one is much more seeing education in a vacuum. I'm wondering how we can take the model of No Child Left Behind and start thinking a little more holistically. What avenues can we add to it that would allow it to move from a kind of a education in a vacuum perspective to more of a inclusive village approach so that businesses and not-for-profits and all of the city institutions see themselves as responsible for education as well as just the academic community. Hope that made sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what you've hit on is kind of the nut of the role of the state and federal state government versus the federal government, and of course local school boards as well. And it is, you know, kind of where we enter, where the federal policy enters the discussion. And it is, in my opinion, necessary but by no means sufficient step for high quality education for our kids. We do know that if you can't read and cipher on grade level, that the prospects that you're going to be a superstar in other fields are limited. So now that we have, I think, for state policymakers, this highway, this infrastructure in place, you ought to be looking at, okay, well what are other dimensions that we ought to figure out measuring? Are there other subject areas, social studies, the sciences, should we look at? When I hear people say, well, what if this is narrowing our focus around our neediest kids? Of course, that's always been the role of the federal government. Mm-hmm. But how are the kids doing at the 50th percentile and the 90th percentile? I mean, we now know all of this information, and you can ask yourselves that. So it is a first step, not the total picture by any means. The other thing I think I would say is that we're just developing kind of the science around assessment and measurement and practice because of this law, and it's in its infancy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have a lot of criterion reference tests, pencil and paper tests, but can we do other types of assessments? Absolutely. But we haven't heretofore didn't have much in the way of science around really any kind of valid, reliable, comparable, sort of broad-based, widespread assessment system. So we're just starting.
If the states were incented in some way, by No Child Left Behind to become much more village-focused and begin to come up with strategies that would engage a broader community in the world of education? Because really, what No Child Left Behind did right at the first part of it, at least from the perspective of, from our view, was it caused everybody to back off and say, okay, now you guys have your job. We have a way to evaluate you. Do education. And so now we're trying to say, no, 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 it's not our job to do education for you. It's our job to do education with you. And so now trying to engage all of those other entities that affect a child.
Sure.
In education is something that we're trying to move toward. It would be nice if that was recognized as part of the assessment of from the federal level of states that become very effective in doing that.
Yeah, but I think absolutely, but it's not a trade-off for we're going to not have the expectations that kids, you know, read on grade level.
Right,
at some point in time, that's still the necessary first step. But this is, you know, you'd mentioned Senator Kennedy. There's a lot of discussion about multiple measures, different ways. I mean, that's all fine and dandy, but it has to be valid, reliable, comparable, you know, sound assessment. I mean, this sort of put the money out and hope for the best like we had for 40 years, we didn't have much to show for it.
And I think that the mistake was we thought we could buy it. And I think that now there's a recognition that we need to be involved, and it takes human touch in order to bring those kinds of changes. But the average child in the inner city is not ready to achieve the standard that they're held accountable to when they walk into the classroom, not because of their inability, but because of lack of preparation. And I think part of that is environmental preparation as well as it is educational preparation. So as much as we can look at this is what it takes to get a child from here to here, then that's when we start seeing the kind of success. And I think you, what you reward, you incent, and you usually see happen.
Amen.
So hard to figure out where he is.
Sybil?
You mentioned Missouri High Standards, and we're, I think most people are very proud of those. But it also presents a problem with our parents, and our teachers and students work so hard to attain these. And we look, we're comparable on the NAEP and other areas, but then we get our hands slapped by AYP and some other things. What's going to happen in 2014 when we get, we're not where we're supposed to be after pushing so hard? How do you justify this to your community?
Well, and obviously these are calls that state policymakers make all over the country. And you know, it's the old he who has the gold makes the rules kind of precept. You know, we're a 9% investor in education, and those things, those discussions are going to happen at the federal level, at the state level. I think a couple of things I would say. One is I think we owe our publics an explanation of, and I think they do get this, that, you know, you have set the bar high. I mean, you have world-class standards, and your kids are the better for it. But yeah, I think things like the growth model, the opportunity to say, you know, here's where we took your child from this point to that point, you know, can help sort of make that case that we're on the way to a world-class standard, but we also recognize where we're starting. That's probably a better sell than, you know, we're only going to expect our kids to be down here and all of the unintended consequences that go with that. But, you know, until we get better assessment and a kind of a growth kind of notion, I think it's continually a struggle for us trying to explain it to the public. But you've applied for growth model, and we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, we will. Can I ask one?
Sure. Quick one.
Quick one, I understand. We've been doing NCLB, and I know that's the main thing you came out for. But do you think there's a real possibility that the career ed funding will be gone again, or will it be kept by the legislature again as it was last year? Do you have any feel for that?
I think they'll probably keep it. I mean, if I had to, you know, make a wager.
It's we think it's of significant value, particularly in some areas, mm-hmm. and I just would hate to see it gone. But on the other hand, if it looks like it's going to be gone, then we have to deal with the state legislature and those to try to figure out how to work with
yeah.
it. And it's
I don't think it will be gone, but I do think there is. We all have a responsibility. I do. We all do to start to answer the question about efficacy and
sure.
rigor on those programs. I think
I
there's
agree.
a perception in the Congress that there's kind of a two-track system. There's the college-bound kind of track, and then there's the vocational education track, and never the twain shall meet. And
right.
we can't sustain, you know, selling that kind of philosophy to really any policy body these
right.
days.
I agree with that. I mean, I don't,
you know?
I don't have a problem with that part.
Yeah, yeah. But we got to make the case. I
but
guess
it does make. Yeah,
yeah,
we didn't need to. Okay.
So,
right.
and anything you can do to help, you know, show that you have rigor. In your voc ed programs that are aligned to your state, all of that kind of thing is very useful.
Yeah, it is helpful. Okay, well that's good. I mean, it didn't seem like there's a strong likelihood, but you just never know when they get.
You just never know. I do want to have that little caveat out there.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true.
Question.
Sure.
I want to go to point number three about the high school rigor and relevance. To me, I'm influenced by my participation on the board, national board, to discuss middle school, of course. But to me, it seems like what we do in middle school determines a lot of what success we're going to have in high school. And so when we talk about the rigor of high school and the relevance, first of all, how do we measure relevance? It's easy to measure rigor. And then will we have policies, and how will we have policies that look at the bridge between middle school and high school, or the middle school age and high school? Will we have policies that would look at that a little more closer?
Yeah, I think three things that I would say about that. One is, and to pick up on Kent's point, this idea that our vocational and career technical programs need to be, you know, aligned to high standards and very engaging for kids. And I think, you know, I can't speak for Missouri, but I think generally speaking, we have a ways to go before we do that in adequate ways. So let's make voc ed matter and useful to kids. Secondly, I think this whole idea, and there are federal funds available for this, advanced placement, international baccalaureate, programs that have, you know, college-ready rigor in our high schools and middle schools, the pre-AP kind of track are very important also. And again, we all often see kind of a rationing of that. So if you're in suburbia, there's 23 AP classes, and if you're in the inner city, there's maybe one or two. And so, you know, we know kids can't learn what they haven't been taught.
Right. And that's increasing in Missouri, just to let you know.
Yes, I know you all have invested in that, and congratulations. So, and you know, there, as I said, there are more federal monies available for that expansion, I hope, again this year. So that's the second thing. And the third thing is Striving Readers is a program that the president has requested more money for. It's fairly small now. But I think we have observed that, you know, where we once thought, you know, kids got reading instruction in the early grades, we're now finding our middle and high school teachers having to sort of become reading teachers as well. And what are the things that we can do to get some of that good brain science and reading pedagogy that has been so useful and frankly helped us get some good results? How can we bring that to our middle and high schools in ways that work for kids and do it in a way that's appropriate for that older learner?
My feeling that if teachers are trained to do it, you can incorporate reading instruction at any level in any subject.
Absolutely.
But it's easier at elementary school.
It is easier probably in elementary.
Now, one of the hardest things I've ever done was to teach a remedial reading class to college freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
It's pitiful.
Well, the good news is we have a lot more brain science and research around how to do that now than we did maybe when you were working in that field. So I think we know more about it.
Now, I guess my other question is on point five, of course. I'd be the one to bring it up since I'm the shy one in the group.
You've noticed that, haven't you?
The issue of resources.
Yeah.
It seems like the only way, number one, the federal government is not going to be able to provide the resources necessary that are perceived as necessary to achieve what we want to achieve. So obviously the resources are going to have to come from the private sector and involvement in the system overall. What can better encourage that as we go forward from No Child Left Behind, and I understand it is the state's and the local government's responsibility to move in that direction, but I guess I'm pushing for some encouragement to see some connection from those who are supporting the educational the educational leaders.
You know, a couple of things. I think the data, and particularly since you all have a very strong system, you know, we now can make our case very well to the public and the business community about where we are, what we need, who needs it, where. You know, are we weak? Do we need more emphasis on math, or is it reading? Is it St. Louis, or is it Columbia? Is it, you know, so we know a lot. And one of the things that I've asked the business community to do, the National Chamber and others, is if they could get some of their, get more coordinated from a philanthropic sort of viewpoint, so educators are not receiving, like, you know, it's Monday and we're fill-in-the-blank corporation, we want to help with science, and Tuesday here comes so-and-so on math, and that mm-hmm. they, you know, knit their contributions together around what our data is telling us that we need. And obviously you all have an active business community here in this state, and you certainly, you know, ought to engage in that conversation about what does the data tell us and what is it that you're willing to do and how do they knit together.
You want my follow-up thoughts?
I think Stan, best I can tell, they're going to listen to you because you're not going to let them off the hook, are you?
I guess I would like to see in the assessment, even if it doesn't offer a massive value, those states that have come up with strategies to engage. I mean, as that's highlighted along with the rest of the assessment, not that it offers a certain value, but I think the recognition that that's a village approach to education as a part of the assessment of No Child Left Behind, I think would add an incentive for businesses, and it would give a recognition that would give us much more ammunition when we hit the ground running to try to make a case for ourselves.
I just have to say that, you know, we have to start where we are and build on it, because to go away from, you know, to back to the good old days of not finding out where we are, as painful as it is, the good old days of wishing and hoping and praying and putting the money out and, you know, kids moved through the system year on year, that's not acceptable. That's not where we want to be either. So, you know, this is a necessary first step, but it's by no means, you know, the totality of everything we ought to be doing for our kids.
So I'm hearing you say that we'll hold on to the standards because we know that that's the right thing to do. And in addition to that, we might consider adding some components to measure.
If I were in the state legislature and a state board of education, I'd be looking across the spectrum at how well we're serving our kids at the 50th percentile and at the 90th percentile. I'd look at other subjects. I'd look at other, you know, kind of, I'm an accountability nut.
Russ, are you going to talk? Can I close this off?
I was going to make one comment, okay. And that is that I think that No Child Left Behind has focused attention strongly on minority groups. Prior to this, we did our testing of children in general, the entire population, and it showed pretty well. But as you look at the achievement of minority groups, and we have a number of them in Missouri, an increasing number of minority groups in Missouri, that becomes a point of frustration. It's part of the value of No Child Left Behind, but it's also part of the frustration that educators face. It's my impression that educators across the state of Missouri are doing a better job than they've ever done before teaching our children. I really believe that. But they have a level of frustration. For example, I mentioned this in a committee meeting yesterday, that I received a call from a principal in Columbia that pointed out that Jefferson City has become a site for African students that are from Africa, where that portion of Africa is involved in terrible wars, killing numbers of people. They're accepting those children in Jefferson City and assigning them to other school districts that are willing to accept them, like Columbia, and that's positive. That's positive. But these children, for example, come to this particular school, and they may be 10, 11 years old in elementary school, and they not only do not speak the language, but they have never been to school in Africa. And yet, this particular subgroup is going to have to be tested in the fall. and their test scores are going to be included in the total test scores of this particular school building and the other school buildings throughout Columbia. I think that's the point of it. That's the value of it. That's the good part of it and the bad part of it. The good part of it, it focuses attention on the achievement of those children that need to achieve. But it also is the frustration of school districts that are doing a good job teaching children, and simply common sense would tell you that those children aren't going to do well on tests. They won't even have the English language under control by the time they have to be tested, and they've never had formal education before. I point that out, not that you're going to solve the problem here with us today, but these subgroups are part of the value of the No Child Left Behind, but that's part of the big frustration on the part of school districts as they struggle with it. We were in St. Joe, for example, and the population in one of the elementary schools, and that was in November, mm-hmm. one of the yes. The population in that particular elementary school had a turnover rate or mobile rate of 300%. 300% by November. Well, that's you struggle to teach children that are that you don't have access to for any extended period of time. And we have to recognize all of that when we're talking about No Child Left Behind. That's not to criticize it. It's just to indicate that we need some degree of flexibility. When we form a policy, when state legislatures form a law, that law impacts every segment of the state of Missouri. And yet there's a big difference throughout the state of Missouri in terms of how that law will impact that particular section of Missouri. I want to again thank you for coming with us. Thank you for your questions to the board, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Kent. I don't expect a response to that. That was just a comment.
May I
make one last question?
That's a good thing. No, you don't. we're going to finish her up.
Okay.
She's got to go across the street and spend a little time over there. And before we do that, we're going to step back here, and she's going to answer a few questions for the media folk who are here. I want to say thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
You can tell that we work for a board in Missouri that has some opinions, and they don't mind to share their opinions. And you know, most of those are easily answerable. They're just money and thoughts and all that behind them. But thanks for coming.
No, thank
it's
you.
Nice to have you here, and. We're glad that you recognize that we're doing some things well and we can improve others, and that's part of the game. So
we're
not there. So thanks, sure. And good luck on the flight out of the state today, too.
God willing, there will be one.
So.